1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Former Governor Nikki Haley voting in her native South Carolina in that state's Republican presidential primary. Not expected to win, but telling reporters she hopes to be competitive.
We're going to be campaigning all day today, and then we're going to keep going all the way through Super Tuesday. That's as far as I've thought in terms of going forward.
Former President Trump pulling about 30 points ahead of Haley. 2 years to the day since Russia invaded Ukraine. With Ukraine running out of ammunition and artillery, Russia making gains and preparing a push on multiple fronts. Russian officials have given Alexei Navalny's body back to his mother following a week of stalling. It remains to be seen if the Kremlin, clearly fearful of a large crowd of supporters, lets him have a proper funeral in Moscow. U.S. officials say that a high-altitude balloon first spotted over Utah is now drifting over the Atlantic Ocean. They're calling it a hobby balloon. The incident calling to mind the Chinese spy balloon shot down just over a year ago. This is ABC News. Some signs of movement in efforts to free the hostages in Gaza. Israeli media citing sources saying that the Paris peace talks made significant progress. This as the Hamas-run health ministry reports the death toll in Gaza is nearly 30,000 aid groups, warning of the potential for widespread famine. More from ABC's Marcus Moore in Tel Aviv.
There is concern about Israel's looming military operation in the southern city of Rafah and what that could mean for the million Palestinians who have taken refuge from the fighting there. Aid groups are saying they have nowhere else to go. And Israel is warning that they will go into Rafah if Hamas doesn't release the hostages by Ramadan, which starts in March.
The Federal Trade Commission is accusing tax preparer H&R Block of deceiving its customers. The federal agency says the business markets free tax preparation products, then pushes consumers to use more expensive ones. The FTC says one of the ways they do that is by deleting all of the data taxpayers have inputted once they try and downgrade from pricier options. Dave Packer, ABC News.
Matt Nair on air.
Hovde, Eric Hovde now. He will be running against Tammy Baldwin.
He's not a Wisconsinite. He threw his hat in the ring from California. This is Tim Michaels all over again. Businessman who walks in and goes, well, I can take care of this. And Wisconsin says, no. Good to know you. Here's some Kringle. Go back home.
Is that how we politely blow people off now? Is to take a Kringle and go away.
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You know, I hope this is the best hour of your life. I'll tell you that. The Cripes Cast, folks.
Comedian Mary Mack.
He's noticed a very sizable increase on people off the lake coming onto our lake to fish it. You don't want everything to be popular and known about. That seems to be the way I also approach my comedy, Charlie. I think there's a theme.
Cripes Cast every Saturday and Sunday at noon across Civic Media and on the Civic Media app.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. People with student loan debt have a chance to get their payments lowered or even have their balances forgiven altogether. But as Alex Gonzalez reports, people with older loans in particular will have to act quickly.
The U.S. Department of Education will be conducting a one-time payment count adjustment this coming summer. Cora Hume is an attorney with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and says borrowers who have non-federally held loans must consolidate them into a direct consolidation loan with the Department of Education by April 30th to reap the potential benefits.
Older borrowers are less likely to hold direct loans, which would already benefit from this pay count adjustment. And then those that do own direct loans, they're less likely to participate in this IDR program that caps their monthly payments based on family size and income.
Hume says the Department of Education will give borrowers credit through its income-driven repayment program for repayment periods from July 1, 1994. 32% of older borrowers are struggling to pay their bills, which is why she encourages folks to call 1-800-433-3243 or visit studentaid.gov/loan consolidation to find out if they're eligible for the significant adjustment. Hume says nationally there are 1.1 million older borrowers that are not in the direct loan program and hold an average debt of $29,500 in student debt.
The three loans that must be consolidated to receive this payment count adjustment is the commercially managed federally family education loans, the health and education assistance loans, and Perkins loans. Another loan that sort of is a quasi need for consolidation are Parent Plus loans.
Hume says the upcoming deadline has the potential to change lives and suggests taking action sooner rather than later. I'm Alex Gonzalez. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, lots of sunshine, highs in the mid-30s and a bit breezy. Breezy tonight, mostly cloudy and a low around 32. For Sunday, partly sunny, near 50 degrees. Into the mid-50s for Monday, still breezy. Chance of showers on your Tuesday, warm with highs in the low 60s. Right now, it's 28.
From I-43 to I-41. This is the Talk of Green Bay. 1590 AM and 97.9 FM, WGBW.
Hi, I'm Aaron, producer for the Todd Allbaugh Show here on Civic Media. You are about to hear an episode of Lost in the Middle, America's Political Orphans, a podcast created by former Congressman Scott Klug. And Todd and I are helping work things out, too. This isn't the first episode, but don't worry, you haven't missed anything. We're just airing select episodes along with some bonus content afterwards from some of the interviews that didn't make the cut into the actual show. Enjoy!
Lost in the Middle, America's Political Orphans, is brought to you by the American Property Owners Alliance, safeguarding the dream of property ownership. Episode 4, how the sale of a used car in 1995 blew up the American media.
I'm standing on a rooftop looking out over London. At the moment, everything is quiet.
CBS's reputation as a journalism giant began on the rooftops of London during World War II with the iconic Edward R. Murrow.
Off to my left, far away in the distance, I can see just that faint, red, angry snap of anti-aircraft bursts against the steel blue sky.
Walter Cronkite's national ratings at his peak in the 1970s would make it the number one rated show on TV today, with a U.S. population that is now twice its size.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, some 38 minutes ago.
And today, this is what passes for news on the network's legendary 60 Minutes, Marjorie Taylor Greene.
People say that you are Trump in high heels.
I didn't intentionally style myself after President Trump, but I can see how people draw those similarities. We both come from the same industry, construction. I also have pretty much a plain speaking style, and so does he.
Lord help me. I spent 14 years in TV winning Emmy Awards at stops in Seattle and Washington, D.C., but this is not the journalism I signed up for when I went to Northwestern's journalism school. In our ticket-splitting episode, we introduce you to Rich Thau, who runs focus groups, where he probes people on candidates and issues. As a favor to me, he asked a focus group in Michigan about trust in the media. These are 13 swing voters from around the state. He asks people often to raise their hands, yes or no, on questions. The first time I watched this response, all I could think of was the exchange and Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Bueller? Bueller? Anyone? Anyone?
Show of fingers. Who thinks the media in the U.S. is even-handed? None of you? No. Okay.
And when he asked participants about their skepticism, listen to this response.
I believe that they report what they're being paid to report. For instance, if it's run by someone that is primarily Democratic, they're going to report things that are pro-Democratic and con for Republicans, and vice versa. If it's owned by someone who's Republican, it's going to be pro-Republican, con-Democrat.
By a show of fingers, how many of you agree with Lori's comment? Wow, nearly all of you.
During his heyday, Walter Cronkite was the most trusted person in America. Gallup polling says today, 2 out of 3 Americans have little or no faith in the media. That's bad news for a democracy which needs an informed electorate, and that makes decisions very tough for swing centrist voters.
I'm Scott Klug. I've been an Emmy Award-winning reporter, a four-term member of Congress, and a federal lobbyist. And like a huge swath of the American public, I'm lost in the middle. This 14-part podcast explains how we got into this mess, where the extremes now pass for the normal. And we're going to try to understand when politics turned into a blood sport and gleefully point the fingers at some of the people we think are to blame. And we'll offer up some green shoots of hope on how America can turn it all around. Hang with me as we walk through a series of media trends that have all impacted voter behavior. The shrill tone of cable TV, the roots of news bias, the newspaper desert across the United States, the relationships between local news coverage and ticket splitting. But first, let's talk about an important moment when TV news pivoted from low-key Walter Cronkite broadcasts to a full-on clown show. When I worked at King TV in Seattle, local television was at its heyday. The networks had incredibly high ratings and money was pouring in. One of my friends was a talented producer who created a highly rated and highly profitable local program. Randy Douthat, from time to time, used to give me a ride home since we lived in the same neighborhood. About the same time I jumped ship to television in D.C., Randy left too, and we'd lost touch with each other. But when I got elected to Congress, I got a phone message and an invitation from him. Oh yeah, the phone message was to appear on Crossfire. My friend Randy had created the show, and he freely admits he'd tell his co-host to amp it up and create conflict.
Bob, the question is not whether it's okay to burn the flag. It's not unconstitutional.
But it is.
Oh, maybe
don't
speak
to
me like that.
Hey, don't say that's not going to be us.
The show was a top 10 hit, and its weekly verbal pie-throwing stayed on the air for decades. Maine professor Michael Sokolow is a CNN alum, and his dad was Walter Cronkite's producer. Political talk shows have always been a staple of network TV.
Keep in mind that before Crossfire, there was Point Counterpoint on 60 Minutes. And before Point Counterpoint, even in the mid-60s, there was Firing Line with Buckley, where he would interview Muhammad Ali and Noam Chomsky. So there's a history of respectful exchange on television. What Crossfire did is it turned it into sports talk.
Do you think the Founding Fathers really had the First Amendment, that they gave us the First Amendment to defend songs that glorify Satanism and incest and suicide? You really believe
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely.
You really believe
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I believe it.
Well, you're an idiot, then.
Mr. Tell you what, kiss my How do you like that?
The show, a CNN staple for nearly 30 years, was finally pulled from the air after a tongue-lashing from comedian Jon Stewart.
I made a special effort to come on the show today because I have privately amongst my friends and also in occasional newspapers and television shows mentioned this show as being bad.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that that wasn't fair, and I should come here and tell you that I don't. It's not so much that it's bad as it's hurting America. This, you're doing theater when you should be doing debate, which would be great.
No, it's not honest.
What you do is partisan hackery.
The Stewart interview killed the show. It was canceled the very next day. But my old friend Randy pushed back hard on all the criticism.
Why does he get to say this, that the democracy is damaged and we have to listen to him? It's freedom of speech. What is wrong with you, my friend? What's wrong with you? Freedom of speech. You know, some of these people take it too far. You know, they're screaming fire in a theater. Can't have that.
So when you watch cable news today and you turn on MSNBC and Fox and CNN and whatever, what's your read on the current sort of zeitgeist on political coverage?
Well, everybody's taking sides now. It wasn't like that before. CNN was a truly balanced news program, but not anymore. You know, should they be giving their opinions? You know, it's like, well, do you believe them? I mean, are you cognizant of the fact that they're expressing their opinions and not just telling the story? You know, I think it could be dangerous. I think it absolutely could be dangerous.
But sheepishly, Randy quietly admits in some ways that his baby in turn gave birth to the madness that's Fox and MSNBC.
But in all fairness to everybody else, I'm probably just as guilty. You know, I think you just pointed that out, that that I'm one of those that created a bit of a monster.
Well, what happened to Randy? Well, he took the lessons he learned from Crossfire to create an even bigger hit.
You are about to enter the courtroom of Judge Judith Scheindlin. This is Judge Judy.
Judge Judy, you can't make that up. Is it really that hard to connect those dots? But the old world he left behind is a tough business slog these days. The economics are squeezing the cable networks and forcing them to lean hard into their audience, extreme right or fringe left. Michael Sokolow, one more time.
What's happening now, and this is very recent, I would say this is within the last 18 months to 2 years, is cord cutting has accelerated so much and people have dropped their subscriptions so much that the need to appeal to your core viewer who's going to keep paying, who's also your advertising demographic, has become much, much more important. And so you find MSNBC going further to the left, you find Fox News going further to the right, because those are the demographics that are willing to pay to keep their cable bill and to buy the advertising. And so that's essentially the process we're in right now. What surprises me is how much it's accelerated in the last 2 years.
The cable news outlets, by historic standards, have tiny audiences. Remember the kerfuffle about Trump's appearance before a live audience on CNN in the summer of 23? The appearance that night had one-third of the ratings of Wheel of Fortune and less than Judge Judy. Audiences are down because people are convinced television news is slanted. For a nuanced analysis, check out a website called All Sides. We have a link on our website, lostmiddle.com. Its editors would claim that every outlet, print, broadcast, internet, they're all biased. Its founders came out of the early tech world at Microsoft, and they were frustrated because rather than the internet bringing people together, it was sorting them out into warring camps.
Did you know that low housing supply is the primary driver of rising home prices? This locks buyers out of the market and increases the tax burden for current owners. We need elected officials to implement common sense solutions that will increase housing supply and put the dream of home ownership back within reach. Hold your representatives accountable to support real solutions to improve affordability. Join us today at PropertyOwnersAlliance.org.
Julie Mastrine runs the All Sides Bias Project, which has been analyzing stories since 2012. They like to use three-person panels to review material, one Republican, one Democrat, and one Independent. It scores coverage based strictly on the language in the reporting. What they've established is a media chart. They use multiple touch points to score bias, and here's just one example.
But we do train our bias reviewers on what to look for that can show bias, and word choice is probably one of the biggest indicators of bias. So a really obvious example of that would be, is the media outlet calling immigrants illegal aliens, or are they calling them unauthorized migrants or asylum-seeking migrants or something like that? So some of the language that we see from the left on that issue kind of softens the issue and kind of obscures the illegality of the act. And then the word choice we see from the right focuses more on the illegality of what's going on.
The research splits the media into five silos. Far left, MSNBC is here. Left, the New York Times. Center, Reuters, and the BBC. Leans right, the Wall Street Journal. And far right, Fox and Newsmax. And she's delighted that all the media camps grouse.
Mostly we get people who are really grateful for what we're doing. I'd say that's the overwhelming amount of feedback. People know that they're in a very messy and polarized media environment. And I think they're grateful for people who are out there trying to give a meta-analysis and help people sort through all the muck and the noise. But then we do sometimes get accused of being right-wing, sometimes get accused of being left-wing. And we figure we're doing a good job if we're getting accusations from both sides and kind of angering both sides in different ways.
Look at the demographics of the reporters who work for the major media outlets. It's a bubble. In fact, it's both a geographic and a political bubble. Talk about diversity in the workforce. Pollster Nate Silver of 538 pointed out the epidemic of groupthink in the media, in part explained by the fact that only 7% of journalists self-identify as Republicans. When Trump won the election in 2016, national reporters were stunned. Following that election, Jack Schaefer, the media columnist at Politico, did a deep dive on the demographics of the national press. From Jack's story, 72% of all internet publishing or newspaper employees work in a county that Hillary Clinton won. As Jack concluded, quote, "So when your conservative friends use media as a synonym for coastal and liberal, they're not far off the mark," end of quote.
I wish there would have been a little bit more introspection on the part of journalists about why do people think you're biased, as opposed to just brushing it off. You know, smugness is not a business model.
Meet Charlie Sykes, former newspaper reporter, radio talk show host, and now columnist.
What's making it worse and worse is as you have this bifurcation of the media into these alternative realities, and it's different audiences where they will feed the audience what the audience is expecting and it wants. And if it doesn't, there'll be tremendous backlash. You're seeing this at Fox, but you're also seeing this at other outlets as well.
So let's turn off the TV for a while and switch to the newspaper world and its impact on today's political zeitgeist. There's no way to tell exactly where, but the death spiral of newspapers started with a used car purchase somewhere in America in about 1995. Might have been an 84 Oldsmobile Cutlass, for all we know. That's when the first transaction happened on Craigslist. For anyone under 30, this sounds a bit bizarre, but for years, huge classified sections in Sunday newspapers is where most people shop for cars, houses, and jobs. Classifieds were a $19 billion business before Craigslist. 90% of it has since disappeared. And the business just got worse. At the same time, subscriptions were dropping because readers were scrolling through online sources, which were free and a lot more convenient. The arrival of mobile devices accelerated that trend. Paul Gillen is a former reporter who started a website called, ominously, Newspaper Death Watch.
It wasn't one event, but it was a sequence of events triggered by the internet. That between about 1995 and 2010 virtually destroyed the industry. 2006 was the best newspaper best year the industry ever had. In 2005, I wrote an opinion piece predicting that the newspaper industry was about to enter a cataclysmic death spiral, and I sent it to several newspapers, and it was rejected by all of them. And I thought, well, no one wants to hear this. I thought, one thing, you know, they're whistling past the graveyard here, because I think it was evident to anybody in the technology realm that things were changing rapidly.
Newspapers in recent years have been closing at the astonishing rate of two a week, and the few survivors are on life support.
How many people open a newspaper every day now? It's a tiny number. We tune to our personal sources we trust now, which in many cases are sources that have a political agenda or a bias, and will tell us what we want to hear. And so our ability to get that objective, professionally curated view of what's going on in the world is really gone. Very few people do that anymore.
But businesses change. Industries come and go. Did anybody cry when electric bulbs replaced candles? But this is different. The press plays a vital role in democracy, informing the public, and very importantly, keeping an eye on public officials. Charlie Sykes.
You know, newspapers that have just vanished or have become ghost newsrooms. I mean, places that used to have 300 reporters now have 15. So what this means has been the collapse of local journalism. Which has been really something. So the watchdog function that we used to take for granted has disappeared. I mean, the number of state houses that simply don't have the kinds of reporters they used to have.
As we always try to do in our podcast, first a cautionary tale, and then let's give you a little glimmer of hope. So let's look at a couple of studies that demonstrate how the newspaper desert is impacting our democracy.
It's not the same set of values. It's not the same local investment. It's a sort of an outdated business model that is being stripped of its parts till they can't do it anymore.
Penn State professor Joshua Dyer and two colleagues did a groundbreaking study. Saving money at the local level means fewer reporters and editors, and by default, much more national coverage. So that a lot of the glue that holds communities together disappears. Some of the most locally, civically valuable information doesn't stand a chance.
We're in a golden age of national news. National news is plentiful and everywhere. But when it comes to just the basic minutes of a local city council meeting, that's where we're hitting a desert. So we collected a bunch of data on where newspapers had closed. And what we found was that in communities that lost a newspaper, there was about 1.9% less split ticket voting.
If you listen to our podcast on ticket splitting, I think it's a sign of a healthy democracy. In the fall of 2022, it surged in governor and Senate races, but the dominance of national news over local is eroding the practice.
We use a quote from a political science journal article from the 1950s that calls ticket splitting a privilege almost unique to American voters. Like, this is not something Europeans do. This is not something people under strong party government do, or even necessarily have the opportunity to do. But mixing and matching parties across levels of government, having those decisions informed by local factors, has really been definitional for American government.
Then one day, Josh and his two other professor friends got an unusual message from a Palm Springs, California editor. She wanted their help with an experiment. Meet Julie Manikin.
Well, I had read this research from a trio of academics who were looking at news deserts. And interestingly, what they said was that when local news goes away, that people don't stop consuming news, they just consume more national news, and that they bring the sort of toxicity of national news down to the local level. When I got to Palm Springs, the newspaper there was publishing, you know, a fair number of nationally syndicated columns about Trump, inside the Beltway politics, a lot of stuff that felt very, very far away from Little Palm Springs, California. And so I really believe in the opinion section. I always love reading letters to the editor. I feel it's sort of the window into the soul of a community.
Keep in mind that her paper, The Desert Sun, was part of the largest newspaper chain in America. Gannett owns 217 daily newspapers and a small cargo ship full of weeklies. Its national headquarters is in suburban Washington, which was a world away. And Julie conspired with the editor, without asking permission, God bless her, to take a vacation from the national partisanship. Her directive to the opinion page editor was simple. For a month, the Sun would not carry a single national columnist and would not publish a single letter about national issues. Only columns and letters about local community issues. Before the experiment started, Josh and his colleagues polled Julie's readers in Palm Springs and readers of the Ventura County Star, located about 175 miles north in California. The Star, as usual, packed its opinion pages with columns of dueling D.C. camps. And after the experiment was over, Josh and the other professors were back in the field interviewing subscribers.
It basically showed that polarization continued to rise in Ventura, and in Palm Springs, it either like stopped or started to kind of reverse.
Within a year, Gannett started to offer early buyouts to opinion page editors all across the country. And yes, including the 25-year veteran at the Desert Sun, who essentially understood he had to take the money and run.
I was, you know, really sad to lose Al. But understood his personal reasons for doing that. But I didn't want to lose the opinion pages. And so around that time, people in the community had started talking to me like, hey, we can tell that the Desert Sun newspaper is, you know, not doing so well. You know, is there anything we can do to help? So I said, you know, I called their bluff. I said, hey, well, I'd love it if we started a local foundation here that could really help support the newsroom. We really don't want the opinion pages to go away. And so we're trying to raise money in the community to, you know, basically make this a community supported forum. And it was really quite amazing. You know, we had we were trying to raise $60,000, which was the salary for the opinion editor. And that happened in a matter of like 3 months. People came forward and we had donations from, you know, $10 to $10,000.
The homegrown editor, now funded by the residents, has been on the job for 2 years and keeping up the drumbeat of celebrating the local community. That's what local journalism should look like. And ironically, a lesson Gannett has now learned the hard way. Gannett recently announced it was about to start hiring for those opinion page slots. It slashed just 2 years ago because research shows the local spotlight impacts the bottom line. And as we know now, impacts the ballot box too. When I was in graduate school at Northwestern, one professor stood out. Think of the actor J.K. Simmons. You saw him in Whiplash, La La Land, Spider-Man. Age him about 25 years and add about 25 pounds. That was Ben Baldwin. And he didn't lecture as much as he barked at the aspiring journalist. Silverstein, he screamed one day at my friend sitting next to me. What do you do when your mother says she loves you? As Stu stammered for an answer and looked around the room for help, Baldwin rubbed his hands over his sweating bald head. And then with a clap of his hands, he said, if she says she loves you, check it out. It was all about the facts. So when you visit a webpage or turn on the TV, remember his admonition to we Cub reporters. Be skeptical and check it out. You owe it to yourself, and Lord knows in these days, you owe it to democracy. Here's the team behind Lost in the Middle. Executive producer Jeff Mayers. Producer Todd Elbaugh. Creative team Claudia Luz and Tony Wood. Edited by Aaron Zummers. Music by Brett William. Production at Civic Media. And a quick thanks to our partners at the American Property Owners Alliance.
From the home of the frozen tundra, Green Bay's choice for news talk, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Former Governor Nikki Haley voting in her native South Carolina in that state's Republican presidential primary. Not expected to win, but telling reporters she hopes to be competitive.
We're going to be campaigning all day today, and then we're going to keep going all the way through Super Tuesday. That's as far as I've thought in terms of going forward.
Former President Trump pulling about 30 points ahead of Haley. 2 years to the day since Russia invaded Ukraine. With Ukraine running out of ammunition and artillery, Russia making gains and preparing a push on multiple fronts. Russian officials have given Alexei Navalny's body back to his mother following a week of stalling. It remains to be seen if the Kremlin, clearly fearful of a large crowd of supporters, lets him have a proper funeral in Moscow. U.S. officials say that a high-altitude balloon first spotted over Utah is now drifting over the Atlantic Ocean. They're calling it a hobby balloon. The incident calling to mind the Chinese spy balloon shot down just over a year ago. This is ABC News.
Tax talk with Straight Talk.
You give and you give. This tax season you get with Straight Talk Wireless. You get a reliable 5G network and unlimited data and a new Samsung Galaxy 8.
Bucks beat the Timberwolves. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Milwaukee Bucks' first game after the All-Star break was just what the doctor ordered. The Bucks with a 112-107 win in Minnesota. Giannis with 33 points. Lillard with 21. Malik Beasley with 14 in the second half. Milwaukee dominated the third quarter but looked tired at the end, head coach Doc Rivers.
You know, one thing you can see with our team, I don't know if there's any place to do it, but you can see conditioning because they're playing hard. They were gassed. There were a bunch of guys gassed on our team, for sure. And that's what happens when you play hard defense and hard offense. So we're going to have to try to condition in games, you know, to get that. Because we have to get used to playing that way for 48 minutes.
In New Orleans, a fourth quarter fight left four players ejected from the game, including Jimmy Butler. The Miami Heat went on to win 106-95 over the Pelicans. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, lots of sunshine, highs in the mid-30s and a bit breezy. Breezy tonight, mostly cloudy and a low around 32. For Sunday, partly sunny, near 50 degrees. Into the mid-50s for Monday, still breezy. Chance of showers on your Tuesday, warm with highs in the low 60s. Right now, it's 28.
Hi, my name is Maggie Dawn. You may have already heard that my 6 p.m. show is moving to 2 to 4 p.m. on the Civic Media Network.
And I'm Todd Lovell, still taking care of middays from noon till 2.
Todd, what are you doing?
And I'm Dom, and Crudy and I are still kicking it from 4 to 6 p.m. across the Civic Media Network.
Dom, this is supposed to be about my show. I don't see why any of you guys...
We just want to be sure folks know precisely where to find you.
Right before the greatest radio show ever.
Until now, Crute.
Maggie Dawn, coming to your local station on the Civic Media Network.
2 to 4 p.m.
Right after me.
Oh, for crying out loud.
It's Black History.
Mino and the Mayor in the morning. And the talk of Green Bay all day long. 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Lost in the Middle, America's Political Orphans on Civic Media. Up next, the creator Scott Klug is going to share some of the extra interview content that got cut from the final episode. Enjoy.
Hey, this is Scott Klug. Welcome back. This is a little bit of bonus material to Lost in the Middle. We do this sometimes with our episodes when we've interviewed great guests, and we feel like we've sort of shortchanged you because what you hear are a 10-second clip there and a 15-second clip there. So today I want to have you spend a little more time with Charlie Sykes. So I got to first know Charlie when he was the editor of Milwaukee Magazine. I grew up in Milwaukee. I was working as a reporter in Washington, D.C., and I ended up doing a story in Washington on a guy named Ron Riewald. And Ron Riewald was a Milwaukee native who moved to Hawaii and set up an investment firm. And the investment firm in Hawaii was called Bishop, Baldwin, Dillingham, and Riewald. So Bishop, Baldwin, and Dillingham are sort of signature family names in Hawaii. They were famous and involved, you know, basically from the beginning of when Hawaii had become a state. And Riewald essentially ran a Ponzi scheme. He ended up getting caught and arrested. But the interesting thing is some of the folks who got conned in the scheme were all CIA officers based in Hawaii, and eventually a number of them were scattered around East Asia. It figured into a story about another guy named Craig Smith, who's the only American to beat espionage charges in the last 100 years. And so I went to Charlie and said, do you want to expand a takeout in Milwaukee Magazine on Riewald? And we became friends then. And then later on, he moved to Milwaukee Talk Radio. He's an interesting guy because he grew up in a newspaper family, then was basically a political talk show, but of the sort of civil variety political talk show when they still had them. And so he's been close to journalism for years. And I worked in television for 14 years as a journalist in Wausau, Wisconsin, where I started, and for the NBC affiliate in Seattle, then the ABC affiliate in Washington, then back in Wisconsin when I wanted to get back to kids and family. So I knew Charlie from my political days. Here's why I think he's so fascinating, because he, like me, has really struggled to figure out the culture of contemporary journalism. I think it largely derives from a sense that there are problems in the world, a great, you know, noble profession and a great mission to have. But the problem is journalists tend to see a problem and then want government action to fix it. And I always was puzzled by this going all the way back to my days when I was first a journalism student at Northwestern, because my take was, and it was proved true during my career, most of the stories I did were on government agencies and government programs and crooked government officials that didn't work. So when I was in Congress, my attitude was, why the hell did I need more of them? It really never made sense to me and never really connected. Charlie had the same attitude, and I think has some great thoughts. What the fundamental problem is with journalists, that there's this really what he calls a hive mentality. You may remember from the podcast itself, only 6% of journalists in the U.S. consider themselves Republicans. If you lived in a congressional district where Hillary Clinton got elected and you were a journalist in New York or Boston or in Los Angeles, fairly Democratic and liberal cities, you not only were in a district that Hillary Clinton won, you were in a district where she won it by 66%. And so I continue to have these arguments with my buddies who've turned out to be, you know, very successful journalists, usually in the newspaper business, in places like Los Angeles and Philadelphia and Hartford, Connecticut. And, you know, the interesting twist on this is the way you win prizes in journalism is you do a story about a problem, and then what you end up seeing and celebrating is that there was a government action to fix it, when maybe the real solution was not to have the government involved in it at all. So here's some more Charlie's thoughts about what he sees going on in contemporary journalism. And stay tuned. I think you'll like it a lot. And again, thanks for listening to Lost in the Middle.
There's two things. There's a hive mind among journalists and reporters where they sort of assume that everybody, you know, comes from the same cultural, ideological background that they do. And so, yes, and there are these blank spots. What's making it worse and worse is as you have this bifurcation of the media into these alternative realities, is that you also have the media that becomes, that experiences audience capture, which is and it's different audiences where they will feed the audience what the audience is expecting and it wants. And if it doesn't, there'll be tremendous backlash. You're seeing this at Fox, but you're also seeing this at other outlets as well. So this is part of a problem that we also don't have a shared universe of facts and issues anymore. I mean, it used to be, you know, when you and I were young pups, that, you know, you could listen to, say, conservative talk radio, and I was on there, obviously, but you'd also be exposed to other things that were happening, other points of view. You'd see it in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, or you'd see it in the Madison Capital Times, or the Wall Street Journal, or the New York Times. Now it's certainly possible to live in one of those two worlds and never be exposed to the other point of view at all. In fact, not even know what they're talking about. Obviously it's more extreme now on the right, but it's incredibly naive for folks on the left to think they do not inhabit their own bubbles. And so you have this mutual incomprehension going on here. You know, and when we talk about the media now, it's not just reporting. It's this blurring in of commentary of journalists as activists driving the opinion, whether it's, you know, Fox News or talk radio or whether it's the various blogs. There are so many voices. I mean, remember, Scott, you can remember this, right? When there were three networks and maybe two newspapers. Right. And so that was the news. How many news outlets are there right now? Amazingly, there are dozens. I mean, I read dozens. And yet each one of them tends to exist in its own world. And I think one of the things you discover from my audience capture is when you give the audience something that they don't want, or that offends their preconceptions, there's going to be blowback. And so you're seeing this sorting out getting worse and worse and worse. Of course, you see this most dramatically in what we found out about Fox News with the, you know, emails going back and forth and the text messages. But I think that's just, in many ways, that's just the tip of the iceberg here. Well, I mean, here in Wisconsin, now you probably should talk to somebody like James Wigderson, who, you know, like me, used to be part of the conservative movement, who now also feels that he is a political orphan. I mean, there's, you know, it's a small group. I think on a national level, boy, let me think about that. Josh Kroschauer, who has until recently been writing for Axios, I think really understands the concept pretty well. I think he's now the new editor-in-chief of Jewish Insider, but Josh is one of those guys that I think understands it. Somebody else that I find incredibly interesting is Ree Teixeira, who is a Democrat who has been trying to tell the Democrats, you are losing blue-collar, you know, voters because they are now the new swing voters.
Jeff, do you have any questions?
I am here. I have been paying attention. Charlie, you're great on both sides of the mic, man. All right. No. I mean, I guess the media part is, I don't think you quite asked this. What okay. went wrong? What happened other than the internet? I mean, we can blame Twitter, I guess, but what went wrong?
Oh, I mean, how much time do we have? let's just sort of, disaggregate this in terms of, I mean, you know, one of the great historians can look back on the last 10 years and the death of daily newspapers around the country has been truly extraordinary. I mean, it's not just you know, here or there. It's everywhere. You know, newspapers that have just vanished or have become ghost newsrooms. I mean, places that used to have 300 reporters now have 15. So what this means has been the collapse of local journalism, which has been really something. So the watchdog function that we used to take for granted has disappeared. I mean, the number of state houses that simply don't have the kinds of reporters they used to have. I mean, Jeff, you could probably quantify this better than I can, but, you know, back in the day, how many reporters were there covering the Wisconsin State Capitol? How many are there now? Yeah. One of the consequences of this then is with the collapse of local journalism is everything becomes nationalized. Nobody cares about or knows about what's happening at state government. So everything is now focused on Washington, D.C. and our national politics. And that has become so segmented and so, you know, so tribal that people decide, you know, basically choose your own adventure. And I think a lot of this is audience driven. Let's be honest about it. I mean, the media has made lots and lots of mistakes, which we could go into, and I spent years talking about. But also the audience increasingly has decided that they want the media to be a safe space for them. They want the media to confirm their biases, to give them ammunition as opposed to give them information and not make them uncomfortable. So that's the audience capture that I'm talking about there. So we're living in this extraordinary age of this embarrassment of riches on social media. And I was mentioning to Scott, on any given day, I mean, I'm going to look at the Washington Post. I will look at the New York Times. I will look at Politico. I will look at the Wall Street Journal. But some of the most valuable stuff I get will be from Puck News or Punchbowl News or Axios News or my Twitter feed. We now have access to more information and more news than ever before, and yet we are dumber and more divided than ever. So, you know, it's way above my pay grade to explain how that can happen, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, I'm a former newspaper guy. I didn't root for the demise of newspapers. No. It happened a lot faster than I thought it would.
Yes.
And it's helped us. You know, it's helped us, but it's like, it's really sad. It is sad. You know, you talk about sad, Scott. I mean, sad is the Journal Sentinel building, the old Journal building turning into apartments or condos. Okay. That's sad.
Oh, I cannot tell you how shocked I am by this because you may know this. So I moved here as a kid in 1963 when my father got a job at the old Milwaukee Sentinel, just as it was being merged with the Milwaukee Journal. And so, you know, as a kid, I grew up going down to that building and seeing it. And then, of course, I was a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal and knew how big it was and what the newsroom looked like and how, you know, closely I was the city hall reporter in Milwaukee. We covered city government, you know, like a sports team. And as you also know, I was a vocal critic of what I saw as media bias and made fun of the dead tree. But I will tell you, I had no idea that it would just disappear. and with it disappearing, you have all of those guardrails, all of that shared experience. I mean, it's not that long ago, guys, that if you were in politics, you actually cared about what the media would report. And, you know, now I really get the sense that we have an entire now class of politicians that just does not give a shit because they don't think that the newspapers have any clout, have any reach. They feel that they can simply go to their own partisan outlets and that they will never be held accountable by the media. And this has happened in half a generation. So the whole role that the media used to play in creating a shared political culture is gone. The whole sense of accountability that if you screwed up or you did X, Y, or Z, that it would look bad and that people would know about it, that's also disappeared. So we are, and you know, and to your point, it happened very quickly. So I have to say that, you know, just that thought of the Journal Sentinel building being gone and being turned into apartments is like wow, it's, you know, out of some sort of dystopian novel.
Right. The other thing was, I think, and we're close to the end here, but, you know, the Journal Company, you know, was a monolith there. Yeah. It controlled a lot. And when it broke up, so did the whole media template for Milwaukee.
Yeah, totally.
And then all these media things are just properties now. They're just properties, right? Okay, they're like trading cards. That's and right. And there went all the loyalty. I mean, the Sunday Journal Sentinel had the highest penetration of any metro daily.
More than 500,000.
Yeah.
The subscription was more than 500,000.
Yeah. Well, who, you know, it's a decimal point of that now. So,
we were out 2 weekends ago. My middle son lives in Los Angeles. Tess loves to do the crossword puzzle. So I said, I'll venture out on Sunday morning to try to find the New York Times, but at the very least I can find an LA Times. Yeah. I found a Sunday Los Angeles Times, which looked like what the Waukesha Freeman looked like 10 years ago. It would have taken me 10 minutes to read it. And more to the point, it didn't have a crossword puzzle.
Los Angeles Times.
But it was one of those tangible things where you picked it up. I had buddies of mine that I went to Northwestern with who worked for the LA Times, who all took early buyouts, you know, 12 years ago or whatever it was. And it was, there was really a sense of, boy, the world's just changed. I mean, if the LA Times looks like that, who survives?
Well, I mean, and this is, it's kind of the, you know, best of times, worst of times, because, you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal are still, you know, doing, you know, huge work, good journalism. They're fat. They're making money. But then the rest of the country is this total wasteland. It also means that the mistakes and the bias is now magnified. And I wish there would have been, and Jeff, you and I have talked about this over the years, I wish there would have been a little bit more introspection on the part of journalists about why do people think you're biased, as opposed to just brushing it off. You know, smugness is not a business model. And I think there was a deeply ingrained sense that, you know, we can, you know, none of these critics are right. And if you think we're biased, well, you just don't know. Well, what happened was the people who thought they weren't getting straight news, they found alternatives. They found other places to go. And so, but given how dramatic the change has been, to make the argument that, well, you know, if the Journal Sentinel had been less biased, or, you know, if George Stanley would not have been such a complete asshole, you know, things would have been completely different. Well, that's, you can edit that out. So, you know, there was editorial, but I mean, the economic forces were just so overwhelming that I'm just not sure whether there was an editorial answer to all of this, at least for the daily newspaper.
Well, the beginning of the end was when they lost classifieds, right?
And yeah, I don't totally.
That was where it all went to hell. Hey, I was going to tell you that there's a guy, and I forget his name because I'm actually on the road seeing my younger son in St. Paul today, who does focus groups with Axios on centrist voters. And he did them for 16 and for 20. And he's got all these interviews in Georgia and Wisconsin, right, plus also the world. But when I talked to him, I said, do you ever ask questions about the media? And he said, really, not very often. I said, if I send you a couple questions, will you ask them? And he said, yeah, I'm doing a focus group in Michigan in 2 weeks, and I've gotten on a lot of other stuff on my agenda. I'll be glad to ask it. So one of the questions he asked was, so there were two groups of eight, all sort of self-described centrist, moderate voters, however you want, whatever phrase you want to use. And he said, do you think the media plays it straight? Not a single finger went up. It was like the scene in Ferris Bueller, where he's going, you know, anybody in the room, anybody, anybody? It was just, it was amazing. And all ages, all demographics, all colors, all political backgrounds. And it meant the mainstream media has really slit its own throat, and I don't think understands it.
Well, and right now, that's probably the most reliable applause line that you would get in Republican politics right now. I mean, I wish, Jeff, there had been just some, I'm trying to think back, whether was there any moment where, you know, folks in the media, you know, before the deluge, sat down and thought, okay, maybe we got to address these concerns, because this is an existential challenge. You know, my sense was they just blew it off. And when I was on the radio in Milwaukee, you know, at that point, very narrowly, I thought, well, okay, if the newspapers are simply going to ignore everything that we're talking about, everything that we are interested in, everything that this vast number of people in southeastern Wisconsin are concerned about, that's a gift to me, you know, as talk radio. So what they did was they did gift this massive audience to other outlets, some of which turned out not to be honest brokers themselves.
Right. I think you hit upon it. I think there was an institutional arrogance, certainly, right?
Yeah.
And it's just like, if you were working for, you know, the newspaper, well, then, you know, it was the media, and everything else was a pretender. And so, therefore, any accusations against that just didn't ring true, even right. when things were starting to spiral.
Yeah, institutional arrogance, I think, is a good way of putting it. It was a cultural arrogance. And by the way, the model of newspapers where you had really good, you know, reporters and editors who then became in charge, that worked for many, many years. But it also meant that you had people who were perhaps not the most deft entrepreneurs and businessmen, you know, at the helm, you know, when the barbarians came to the gates.
Thanks for listening to Lost in the Middle, America's Political Orphans. Check the podcast out anywhere you get your podcasts or on lostmiddle.com.
Broadcasting from the City Deck Studios on North Washington Street, the Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
It's Black History Month, and Civic Media Radio Network recognizes the importance of this observance. But what do you really know about it? I'm Kelvin Butenhoff, producer of The Earl Ingram Show. Echoes of Empowerment, Black History Stories, will offer thoughtful answers all month long. Now, here's Earl Ingram.
It's Oscar season, and since the award started in 1929, more than 3,000 Oscars have been awarded, but only 60 have been won by Black actors. The first Black woman to win Best Lead Actress was Halle Berry for the film Monsters Ball in 2002. Denzel Washington earned Best Lead Actor for Training Day also in 2002, marking the first time both of the top Oscars were won by African Americans. That hasn't happened since. Listening for more Black History stories here on Civic Media, I'm Earl Ingram.
Mino and the Mayor.
John actually asked me if women had a prostate earlier today.
He did.
You did not.
No, get this, because we're in here and we're talking about...
It was a sweet question.
Yeah.
No, I thought he asked.
What?
He goes,
do you guys know. Do you guys get prostate cancer? And she's like, no, John, women don't have prostate.
A lot of guys don't know that.
Do they have ED?
Erectile dysfunction?
Yeah, do they have that, John?
Weekday mornings from 6 until 8 on the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, and Oshkosh Air Support, WISS.
And on the Civic Media app,
the Todd Alba Show.
Green Bay is a fine town, but I'm just telling you, you're better off to take a horse. Don't drive in Green Bay, and for God's sake, don't get a parking ticket. So how about this? We find out how much revenue does Green Bay get from parking tickets. And we say that the Packers are going to donate that, and we're going to have free parking in Green Bay. How about that? Todd for Mayor of Green Bay.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packard. South Carolina residents casting ballots in the state's Republican primary today. Former Governor Nikki Haley's been trailing in the polls behind former President Trump. Charleston voter Sherry Herring voting for Haley.
Trump's a loose cannon, and he could be in jail. He's got so many, and he's got problems.
But she still says she'll support Trump if he's the GOP nominee. Today marks 2 years since Russia invaded Ukraine. President Vladimir Zelensky today in Kyiv.
On the second anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion, we yet again prove that despite all the difficulties and challenges, Ukraine will become only stronger and will always be together with its partners in the free world.
An Israeli source telling ABC News that Israel has agreed to an updated framework for a ceasefire in Gaza and a hostage deal. Israel now waiting for a response from Hamas. That could take a couple of days. This is ABC News. An arrest in the death of a college student in Georgia. The 22-year-old nursing student found dead near running trails at the University of Georgia.
A manhunt over after police arrested a suspect in connection to the killing of 22-year-old nursing student Lakin Riley after she disappeared following a jog. She was later found dead on the University of Georgia's campus. Jose Ibarra facing multiple charges, including murder, kidnapping, and concealing the death of another.
ABC's Morgan Norwood, and we've now learned that Ibarra's brother has been taken into custody for possessing a fake green card. Both brothers are from Venezuela and not U.S. citizens. U.S. and Canada tracking a high-altitude balloon that was first spotted over Utah Friday. That balloon's now likely over the Atlantic Ocean after moving quickly across the U.S. overnight. It was allowed to continue flying because officials say it posed no threat to national security. The FAA says that the balloon was probably a hobby balloon. Dave Packer, ABC News. After